Unit 6, Exercise 2. The layer covering the Earth like a blanket is called the atmosphere. It is made of very thin stuff called air. Air is so thin you hardly know it's there, but it's all around us. Really, we live at the bottom of a very deep ocean of air. Air gets thinner and thinner as you go up. There's enough air to breathe at the top of Mount Everest, 5 miles above sea level, but getting there is hard work. Most climbers have used breathing apparatus on their way up. By the time you get to 50 miles above sea level, there's practically no air left. The air doesn't stop suddenly, however, so it's impossible to say exactly how deep the atmosphere is. Air is not a single substance. It's made of a number of gases all mixed together. It's impossible to stop gases mixing together. They mix together spontaneously. So a gas that escapes from the Earth becomes a part of the atmosphere. Scientists believe that the atmosphere has changed a very great deal since the Earth was first formed. At first, the atmosphere may have been made up of gases like ammonia, methane, carbon dioxide, and water vapor. Later, the first early forms of life developed, and gradually more and more oxygen was added to the atmosphere. Nowadays, the main gases in the air are oxygen and nitrogen. You can easily perform experiments in a laboratory to find out about the air, for example, to prove that it's a mixture rather than a single substance, or to find out how much oxygen there is in it. These experiments usually involve getting the oxygen to combine with another substance. In other words, to get rid of the oxygen altogether, a chemical reaction is used. There are plenty of ways to do this because oxygen is a very reactive gas. For instance, burning and rusting are two kinds of chemical change that use up oxygen. The main gas left after removing oxygen is nitrogen. In fact, nearly all of the remainder, about 4/5, is nitrogen. To put this another way, 78% of the air is nitrogen. Apart from oxygen and nitrogen, there are only small amounts of other gases in the air. One of them is carbon dioxide. Another of the minor constituents of the air is water vapor. Ordinary air always contains some of it. The best way to show that there is water vapor in the air in the laboratory is to condense the water. This can be done by cooling the air. Altogether, there's not much of either water vapor or carbon dioxide in the air. Both of them are very important. So far, we've mentioned oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and water vapor. Are these the only gases in the air? The answer is no, but it's hard to prove. Evidence for other gases in the air came towards the end of the 19th century, a long time after oxygen and nitrogen had been sorted out. The work leading to their discovery was an investigation into the density of nitrogen. Unlike oxygen, nitrogen is very unreactive, so it's difficult to do experiments to remove nitrogen from the air. But it's quite easy to take the oxygen, carbon dioxide, and water vapor out of the air, practically leaving nitrogen alone. This nitrogen might be called atmospheric nitrogen. The main gas that contaminates the atmospheric nitrogen is argon. Being a very inert gas, it's used for filling electric light bulbs. Exercise 5, number 1. After reading and rereading Dr. Stewart's new book on air, I simply can't understand why some of the reviewers have found something wrong with the conclusions which this famous writer makes.
Number 2. Since the time Dr. Stewart began writing his book, new information has been obtained which clearly shows how questionable the conclusions that he makes are.
Number 3. Dr. Stewart always writes his books in a very understandable manner, but even his clear style cannot hide the lack of understanding of what he describes.
Number 4. It will be a great pity if Dr. Stewart's new book on air is read only by specialists in the field of inorganic chemistry, because a writer of such high qualification surely deserves a much greater audience of readers.
Number 5. Although Dr. Steward's new book on air doesn't contain many pages, I find it impossible to imagine how a better description of the subject could ever be produced.
Number 6. On page after page of Dr. Steward's new book on air, I found statements which my own experience in this field certainly leads me to ask a number of questions.
Number 7. One cannot help expressing pity that more writers in this field do not have Dr. Steward's talent of clear expression combined with convincing proof of his conclusions.
Number 8. There is certainly a great need in this field for a short, general review which combines scientific theory with good literary style, but though Dr. Steward's literary style is worth speaking about, the theory which he tries to develop leaves one unsatisfied.
Number 9. In my previous books in this difficult field, I expressed the opinion that no satisfactory treatment of the subject had ever been published, and after reading Dr. Steward's latest attempt in the same area, I'm ready to report that the situation remains unchanged.
Number 10. In his latest book, Dr. Steward has tried to present the beginning student with a popular introduction to the subject, and, although I am certainly in full sympathy with his purpose, I must honestly report here that in so many popular treatments in the field of science, the effort to give a simple yet true picture of a difficult subject has proved to be far beyond the capacity of the writer.
Exercise 12. Good afternoon. I'm Carl Spreider, and today we're going to discuss oxygen. If you don't understand or follow me, or if you have anything to add, you're welcome to interrupt, okay? Well, to begin with, it's common knowledge. Oxygen is the most abundant element on our planet.
May I interrupt you for a moment? When was it isolated?
You mean discovered? That's a good question. Well, it was discovered by Priestley as early as 1774, but it's not as simple as that, because Lavoisier also made experiments with oxygen, isolating it from air and developing Priestley's work. Lavoisier emphasized the role of oxygen in combustion and respiration. Well, coming back to what I was saying, in nature, oxygen may occur in a free state or may be found combined with other elements. It should be noted that because of its chemical properties, it has been called the most important of all elements to man.
Sorry to interrupt you, but is it because of being a supporter of combustion and of forming oxides with both metals and nonmetals?
Quite right. Let me continue and say that oxygen is a colorless, odorless, tasteless gas. It's slightly heavier than air and is slightly soluble in water. Being compressed and cooled, it can form a pale blue liquid boiling at -192.98 Celsius, which would be slightly magnetic.
I wonder if I could comment on the chemical property of oxygen.
Please.
Well, the outstanding property of oxygen is its activity, correct? In other words, its tendency to combine with other substances.
Absolutely true. It will combine with all the elements.
I have a point to make here.
Yes?
As far as I know, it doesn't combine with inert gases, does it?
Yes, quite correct. Before I can resume, would you answer my question? What happens to oxygen with an increase in temperature?
I guess it would greatly increase the oxygen's activity.
Yes, that's true. Now, oxygen, silicon, aluminum, and hydrogen together constitute approximately 80% of the Earth's crust, sea, and atmosphere.
May I interrupt you again, Dr. Spider? What about nitrogen?
Oh, yes. It's the main element in the air, but it isn't one of the most common elements.
Could I say something about nitrogen?
I'd be delighted to hear.
Nitrogen forms only a small percentage of the crust and oceans, and the mass of the atmosphere is negligible compared to the total mass of the Earth.
That's a good comment, I should say. Speaking about air, can anybody tell me about its composition?
Oh, it varies and depends to a large extent on plants and animals, which control the amounts of oxygen and carbon dioxide by photosynthesis and respiration.
Good. What else does air contain? Anybody?
Water vapor and dust. If dust is removed, then, to tell you the truth, I don't remember the exact figures.
Well, the approximate composition by volume is the following. Nitrogen, 78%. Oxygen, 21%. Argon, 0.93%. Carbon dioxide, 0.03%. Plus small quantities of other gases. Well, thank you for your active participation. Next time, we'll speak about combination of oxygen with metals. What do they form?
Oxides, I suppose.
Well done. See you later. Unit 7, Exercise 2. Non-chemists can't help being surprised to learn that many chemical compounds are obtained from living things. For example, sugars, ethanol, methane, urea, etc. What all these compounds have in common are the elements carbon and hydrogen. Thus, it can be said that nearly all compounds obtained from living things are carbon compounds. In the early days of chemistry, no one even thought to obtain compounds from living things in the laboratory. The idea was that there were special processes going on inside the organism. The special processes were believed to be essential for the formation of the compounds. So chemists considered the compounds from organisms to be somehow special and different from ordinary chemicals that could be made in a laboratory. They called chemicals from living things organic chemicals, and the others inorganic chemicals. However, in 1828, a chemist called Wohler showed organic chemicals to be just ordinary chemical substances. He did this by converting an inorganic chemical into an organic one simply by heating it in the laboratory. Gradually, more and more organic chemicals were shown to be just like ordinary chemicals. But we still use the terms organic and inorganic to divide chemicals into two classes. Nowadays, however, we use the term organic compounds to mean carbon compounds, there being some exceptions to the rule. Most of the organic chemicals we have nowadays are man-made and are obtained directly from organisms. However, the main raw material for manufacturing organic chemicals is petroleum, it having been formed in the past from marine organisms. Why do we have to separate a branch of chemistry just for carbon compounds? Couldn't its compounds be included with those of other elements? There's a simple reason for keeping carbon compounds separate. There are just too many of them. There are more compounds of carbon than compounds of all the other elements put together. Organic chemistry is therefore a very large branch of chemistry. It includes millions of compounds. Most of these are compounds of carbon involving just a few other non-metallic elements, for example, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and the halogens. Why does carbon have so many more compounds than other elements? What is special about it? The answer to these questions is, carbon atoms have the special property of being able to join together to form chains of atoms. The chains may be short, or they may be hundreds or even thousands of atoms long. Since the carbon chain can be practically any length, the number of possible hydrocarbons is enormous. Exercise 10. You're too loud. I'm reading.
What are you reading?
A book.
A textbook? In summer? On vacation?
It's not a textbook, Dolly. It's a book by Isaac Asimov.
I know his books. I have just read a story, Take a Match. He writes science fiction stories, doesn't he?
In general, yes, but this time it's a history of chemistry.
I can't understand. Why chemistry?
Because he is a biochemist and knows chemistry and its history perfectly well. Besides, he is a gifted writer. I'm reading a book like a novel.
What exactly are you reading at the moment?
Organic chemistry.
Organic chemistry?
We'll study it next year.
What is organic chemistry?
It's the chemistry of carbon or organic compounds. They are very important.
What do you mean by organic?
Compounds that may be obtained from animated things.
Animated? Jack, I don't get the idea. I know animated movies, but what does this word mean in chemistry?
It's simple. Living organisms.
Oh, I see. The other thing that I still can't make out is why carbon compounds are so important.
Well, all life depends on water and the compounds of carbon, right? You know why water is essential to us, don't you?
Sure. Because of,
carbon, if I can put it this way, provides molecules of life. Clear?
Not quite. And how did it all start? I mean, who invented or discovered or, say, developed organic chemistry?
You know what? Read this book. It'll open your eyes.
Oh, Jack, I'm dying to read it. Can I take it right now?
No, not now. As soon as I finish reading.
Revision and development. Unit 6 and 7, Exercise 8. Excuse me, Dr. Rowland?
Yes?
I'm Mary Smith, a journalist, writing for Nature. How do you do?
How do you do? Can I be of any help?
You see, I'm writing an article on greenhouse effect and its influence on our future life. It's commonly known that you are one of the best experts in this field, so you could probably answer some of my questions.
I'd be glad to. What exactly are you interested in?
First, I'd like to know if the much-discussed greenhouse effect is really the disaster of our time. I mean, if a gradual warming of the Earth really threatens life itself, or, probably, it's, say, a political tool for environmentalist doomsayers.
Well, for 30 years, scientists have theorized that as harmful gases accumulate in the atmosphere, the Earth's blanket of air will become, if I can put it this way, a global heat trap, triggering long-term and possibly cataclysmic changes in climate.
May I interrupt you for a moment, Dr. Rowland? Has this theory been confirmed?
I should say that individual studies have tended to confirm it. But there are some scientists who have taken sharp exception to a doomsday scenario. They argue that the theory is being used to generate research funding and top further political objectives of environmental groups.
Oh, I see what you mean. I attended some meetings in Vienna and Geneva in August and...
The advisory group on greenhouse gases, right?
Yes, and they learned that the question was no longer whether, but how policymakers would cope with the warmer world by the first half of the next century.
I've heard that.
Dr. Rowland, what I still can't understand is how it's all started.
Well, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution...
Oh, the mid-18th century, as far as I know?
Yes, quite true. Since that time, roughly 20 billion tons of carbon dioxide have been released into the atmosphere from both industrial and natural processes.
What about our time? Can we be blamed for the situation?
Sure. Over the past 50 years, other harmful gases, chlorofluorocarbons, nitric oxide, and methane have been accumulating in the atmosphere.
What are we to expect in the nearest future?
By the beginning of the new century, we'll probably know with more certainty what we face. What we know now for sure is that the world's oceans and forests normally absorb most of these carbon-based byproducts, but geochemists worry that they may be approaching their limit.
Can we say that if the greenhouse scenario unfolds, the Earth will eventually get dried?
Right. What is more, rich farmlands will turn into deserts. Forests will wither and die. Oceans swollen by the melted polar ice will inundate coastal areas.
So, indications of a warming trend are unmistakable, aren't they?
Generally speaking, yes. But at present, no one can say for certain when the dire effects of global warming will be felt.
Dr. Rowland, can you make a forecast?
As I see it, if you have the greenhouse effect going on indefinitely, then you have a temperature rise that will bring the extinction of human life in 500 to 1,000 years.
I see, Dr. Rowan. Then the last question. Can any corrective actions be undertaken right now?
In my view, we should first renew the search for safe, clean alternatives to fossil fuels like coal and oil. Second, decrease the release of harmful gases from industrial processes. And third, stop clearing the tropical forests that absorb huge amounts of carbon dioxide.
Thank you, Dr. Rowan. You've helped me a great deal. Now I've got the idea of how to cope with the situation.
You're welcome. Unit 8, Exercise 2. Life depends fundamentally on organic polymers. If it were not so, we wouldn't have food, clothing, shelter, and transportation. Indeed, nearly all of the material needs of man could be supplied by natural organic products. The list of these materials and things made of them might be very long. Wood, fur, leather, wool, cotton, silk, rubber, oils, paper, paint, and so on. The organic polymers which these things are made from include proteins, cellulose, starch, resins, and a few other classes of compounds. But for the complexity and fragility of the molecules of the natural organic polymers, they wouldn't have defied the attempts to analyze their molecular structure until very recently. There would be no industry of man-made organic polymers were it not for modern methods of physical and chemical analysis, which uncovered the principles that govern the properties of the natural polymers. One could list the principal products, such as fibers, synthetic rubbers, coatings, adhesives, and a lot of materials called plastics. Plastics and synthetic coating are already in common use. It is desirable that they should be used on a large scale and get further developed. Synthetic polymers now available already possess several of the properties required in a structural material. They are light in weight, easily transported, easily repaired, highly resistant to corrosion and solvents, and satisfactorily resistant to moisture. It would be necessary to add that they have long-lived durability and resistance to high temperatures. A very important question could arise over whether synthetic polymers could be made inexpensive enough to compete with the structural materials such as metals and ceramics. The answer could be yes. It might seem odd that man came rather late to the investigation of organic polymers as the principal means of supporting life. The natural polymers such as proteins, cellulose, and other dominated his existence, and even in ancient times, people used these materials. Yet as late as the end of the 19th century, polymer chemistry got little attention. Chemists attacked sugar, glycerol, fatty acids, and other ordinary organic compounds, dissolving, precipitating, crystallizing, and distilling them to learn what these substances were composed of. But only feeble efforts were made to investigate such common materials as wood, starch, wool, and silk. The substances composing these materials couldn't be crystallized from solutions, nor could they be isolated by distillation. It was only in the 20th century that the scientists began thorough investigation of these materials. Having used some powerful physical instruments, an electron microscope, viscosimeter, X-ray diffraction apparatus, they could have revealed the polymers in all their intricacy. Their molecules were incredibly large, the molecular weights running as high as millions of units, whereas simple organic substances such as, for instance, sugar and gasoline had molecular weights in the range of only about 50 to 500. Giant molecules can be composed of a large number of repeating units, they being given the name polymer from the Greek word poly, many, and meros, a part. Many polymers have the form of long, flexible chains. If the chemists had not found that out, they wouldn't have been able to synthesize artificial polymers. This has led to the establishment of industries producing synthetic fibers and numerous polymeric materials, many of which were less expensive and superior in various ways to the natural materials. Exercise 11A.
I can't understand, James. What right have the Americans, and the Russians, or anyone else for that matter, to spend huge sums of money on research into space?
Could I just...
Just a minute. Huge sums of money on research of this kind? We should think about solving our problems on the Earth before we try to make further investigations in space. Just think, if that money were spent on protein research or cell research, for example, what progress they could make. How they could benefit mankind.
True, but there is research that would be of more immediate use. Other kinds, too. Not just research into...
What do you mean? The research into proteins and cells are absolutely necessary. Just think. Proteins are vital to our lives and furnish us with virtually every atom of nitrogen that's found in our tissues.
Yes, yes, right. Moreover, even in the secret of life itself seems to be sealed in a protein molecule. But cloning...
Come on! What's wrong with cloning? Especially now when the Lamb Dollars examination is underway.
And yet, they're questioning the legitimacy of the research.
But James, I feel the research is perfectly legitimate.
Well, I wouldn't say that exactly, but at least this is my way of looking at it. Cloning is absolutely useless. If we spent money on cultivating new foods, discovering new types of foods, well, you see what I mean. Now, when a big percentage of population is underfed...
That's one way of looking at it, but simplistic. You don't always solve the problem by concentrating on it. Solutions often come, how should I say it? Incidentally.
As byproducts?
Yes, if you like, as byproducts of other discoveries. I mean, think a bit. Can you imagine how many problems could be solved as byproducts of protein and cell research? New materials, new nourishing foods, More than that, many of these have already found their way into our homes and, well, little do we realize their origin.
You may be right, Mary, but all the same... Unit 9, Exercise 2. If a chemist or a physicist, or anyone for that matter, endeavored a brief description of the current environmental problems, he would find it troublesome and far exceeding the knowledge of an individual scholar, for the situation with our environment has long, long become a subject of joint research of scientists from different fields who have to combine their wisdom and information from still other domains with experts in sociology, psychology, philosophy, hurriedly coming into the picture. Yet to put it briefly, one of the causes of the current situation with our environment should be searched in the lack of development of particular fields of knowledge and of an inadequate picture of the intricately acting whole, which is our planet. It is man's intervention in nature that has singled him out from the rest of the animal world since his early days. It is this very intervention that has landed him nowadays in this highly technological world of ours, with the rate of progress in particular fields being faster than that in our fundamental knowledge of the general operation of the Earth. It is this very discrepancy between the two rates which appears to be the cause of most of today's problems. This is by no means an exhaustive explanation, overlooking as it does the social factor. The threat to the environment is a demanding problem man has to cope with at the beginning of the 21st century. What is so particular about the environmental crisis when compared to the other menacing problems, that of a nuclear catastrophe, say? Surely not its global character and everybody's involvement. A nuclear catastrophe, as seen nowadays by practically everyone everywhere, would inevitably involve any country, no matter how small or big it is, and would disturb every individual, whatever life he might be living. Should it happen, its inescapability is too obvious to be disputed. So is its explosive character. In contrast to this, the environmental crisis is of an accumulative nature. It is just not clearly understandable, and the intricate pattern of the interaction of all factors that makes it so hazardous. For no single action taken or decision made can bring about an immediate catastrophe, nor could there be the last step that would set in motion an avalanche of irrevocable and immediate events leading to the ultimate doomsday. It is only step by step that we approach the critical point, were there such a thing as point in this context. Consequently, what is needed first and foremost is that we take close to our hearts the possible adverse impact of the long-range effects of our actions, however noble the motives may seem to us at present, on the entire human civilization. Should we fully realize the danger, quite a new approach to the problem would appear. Next comes the urgent need for basic research to get more profound knowledge of the cause-effect relationship, the time factor necessarily taken into account, in the whole realm of human environment, both natural and man-invaded. Fundamental and irreversible as they may often be, the changes in our environment are not likely to bring mankind to the brink of extinction overnight. It would take us some time yet to get there. So let us use the time for learning how to preserve our planet in good shape and in running order for an indefinitely long time. Exercise 10. Dear colleagues, first of all, I'd like to thank the chairman and the organizing committee for their kind invitation for me to participate in such a representative forum and for the opportunity of presenting my new book in front of these high-ranking experts. Let me begin by saying that, but for a publisher's request to develop an essay I had written about atmospheric problems into a book, this volume would never have arisen. In the essay, I have discussed the big three atmospheric issues: acid rain, ozone depletion, and climate heating, and had emphasized how the three problems were related. Well, attempting to expand this theme into a book, I took advantage of invitations to speak about the atmosphere by using each chapter outline as the basis for a lecture. This approach allowed me to test my material both by observing the audience's reaction and by trying to answer the questions that arose. You know, always a few people in any group are truly interested in the details of a technical subject, and they're a joy to address. But the question I received most often was not about detail. It was a request for a judgment. All that science is okay, people seem to say, but tell us straight, are we in trouble or not? And I began to suspect that I shouldn't simply add more technical details to the discussions of the essay. The book should address this commonly asked ultimate question. It's my great hope that I have reached my goal. Dear colleagues, my aim hasn't been to produce just one more careful discussion of the state of the science surrounding acid rains, ozone depletion, and climate heating, but to show why so many workers in this field have become convinced that emissions into the atmosphere have indeed reached a very serious level. The book consists of 7 chapters. The first one introduces 2 overlooked facets of the atmosphere that are essential to understanding today's worries. The next 2 cover 2 of the 3 well-known atmospheric problems, acid rains and depletion of ozone. Climate heating, produced as infrared trapping gases accumulate in the air, is so firmly at the center of all these issues that chapters 4 and 5 are devoted to it. The final 2 chapters, discussing what these problems mean to people, to decision makers, and to civilization, and what can be done about them. Well, to sum up, I'd like to say that I have the privilege of serving on the staff of the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and the constant interaction with other NCAR scientists and with visitors has been the most important influence on my scientific understanding and appreciation of the complex system that is the atmosphere. I would like especially to acknowledge my debt to Walter Roberts, William Kellogg, and Stephen Schneider, 3 modern pioneers in the study of understanding how the atmosphere responds to human activities, and to Michael Glantz, who studies how human activities respond to the atmosphere and its changes. In conclusion, I also wish to express my deepest gratitude to all those who made scientific and important contributions, made critical comments, and helpful suggestions. Thank you. Exercise 14. Number 1. Fuhrer's book is persuasive because it is based more on even-handed analysis than on advocacy. Most of the changing atmosphere is devoted to clear explanations of the relationships between acid rains, climate warming, and stratospheric ozone depletion, as well as to their causes and effects. This book could serve as a primer for anyone confused by the wealth of technical information that has been published about these complex atmospheric phenomena.
Number 2. This is a very interesting book, partly because it provides novel ways of describing concepts such as steady states, numerical modeling, and radiochemical dating to the non-scientist, but more importantly, because it discusses possible solutions to our dilemma.
Number 3. Of John Fury's latest book, I can only say that his and my views remain worlds apart, and I am yield to no one in my admiration for his smooth-flowing literary style. My opinions of what he has to say are quite another matter.
Number 4. The changing atmosphere is a valuable addition to the growing literature on our unique and scary moment in history. It is calm. It is reasonable. Therefore, it is frightening as hell. It is a good short introduction to the situation.
Number 5. When I first opened the package containing John Fear's latest book and read its title, I must admit that I felt a sudden sinking of the heart. Yet, once I had gathered the courage to begin reading, I found the work so far beyond my wildest hopes that I actually missed supper rather than put the volume down unfinished.
Number 6. John Fear states in the introduction to his latest book that it was 4 years in preparation. One wonders, then, why he didn't check his facts with greater care.
Number 7. John Fear does an excellent job of explaining difficult problems in a way that everyone can understand, while presenting much information that should provoke thought in all of us. I recommend it to anyone who is interested in how we are changing the atmosphere that supports our Earth.
Number 8. One cannot quarrel with the nature of evidence which Fear offers in his latest book, but all the same, one cannot honestly accept the conclusions which he reaches on the basis of this evidence.
Number 9. In today's world, it becomes increasingly essential for everyone to acquire some knowledge and understanding of our atmosphere. But to such understanding, John Fear's book will, alas, contribute very little.
Number 10. I'll say just a few words about the changing atmosphere. John Fear provides practical and long-range suggestions for controlling these and other forms of atmospheric deterioration, and it's difficult to see how anyone could find his book anything but completely satisfying.